LR 96.5 FM Sarasota.
On WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Sarah Dennis with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, February 14th. A lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia by 27 religious groups challenged the Trump administration's decision to end a policy that kept immigration and customs enforcement from raiding churches and schools. The groups say the change violates their religious freedoms, creates fear among churchgoers, and disrupts worship and community services. Religious leaders stress that welcoming immigrants is an important part of their faith, and the policy could hurt church attendance and vital services. This lawsuit follows a similar one by Quakers, asking for protection of their rights under the First Amendment and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Governor Ron DeSantis has signed two new bills aimed at speeding up the deportation of undocumented immigrants in Florida. The legislation creates a state board of immigration enforcement and allocates $250 million in grants to local agencies that work with federal authorities. The bills also introduce a death penalty for undocumented immigrants convicted of serious crimes, and repeal in-state tuition for students without legal status. While the measures passed along the party lines, some Republicans voiced opposition, particularly over the tuition chains. The laws come amid ongoing debates about immigration enforcement in the state. The 43rd Annual Cortez Commercial Fishing Festival is happening this weekend, celebrating the village's rich fishing heritage. Despite recent storm damage, the Cortez community remains strong. The festival will feature live local music, seafood, artwork, and educational dog talks from the University of Florida Fisheries Department. You can also explore the Florida Maritime Museum and the Cortez Cultural Center. Proceeds will support the restoration of a 100-acre coastal habitat near the village. With this year's theme, Swamped But Never Sung, the festival honors Cortez's resilience and its vital role in Florida's seafood economy. To participate, just visit Cortez on Saturday or Sunday and enjoy the celebrations without registration. This has been Sarah Dennis with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, February 14th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Typically, I do not use this space to talk about movies, but last week I was physically moved by a Brazilian film, I Am Still Here, that depicted the struggle of one family during the military dictatorship that ruled that country in the late 60s and early 70s. The story centers on the wife of a former congressman who was disappeared by the military for being part of the resistance. Her search through the alleged judicial system for any hint of what happened to her husband was Kafkaesque, where the people who should know deny any knowledge. As another character pointed out, when the people lose confidence in the fairness of the judicial system, democracy dies. Sound familiar? With the Supreme Court stacked and the Attorney General, the top cop in the nation, and the head of the most important federal enforcement agency, the FBI, about to be occupied by self-identified partisan toadies, it's hard to continue to believe the rule of law will prevail. Brazil did finally emerge from that dictatorship to again rejoin the community of democracies, but it took a couple of decades, and they were still susceptible to the allure of a strong man, Javier Bolsonaro. But they were able to not only stop him from overturning the legal election that he lost, but punished him for that criminal effort. Failing to punish those who commit crimes only encourages more criminal activity. And now it seems perhaps the most important lawbreaker who got off scot-free is trying to dismantle all enforcement mechanisms in the country. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Gerardo Reyes Chavez, former farm worker and human rights activist with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and the Fair Food Program. But first, hear how the felon-in-chief still thinks the courts are out to get him. President Donald Trump called the federal judge's ruling a disgrace. Elon Musk, whose Department of Government Efficiency staffers were denied access to Treasury Department computer systems, said the judge should be impeached. Vice President J.D. Vance said judges had no authority to limit a president's legitimate power. These harsh reactions to an adverse decision have led some Democrats and legal experts to voice concern that the Trump administration may ignore unwelcome federal court decisions. The concerns come after Supreme Court Justice John Roberts warned in December against members of both parties defying court rulings. The battle over limits on executive power coincides with Trump's attempts to shrink the federal government and change longstanding policies over issues such as immigration. With Republicans in control of the White House and Congress, opponents of Trump's policies have few avenues outside of the courts to fight back. Trump told reporters Sunday on Air Force One the rulings could still be overturned on appeal. He previously voiced optimism that the Supreme Court would side with him in ending birthright citizenship for children born to parents who are not legally authorized to be in the country. But Trump and other officials are particularly critical of U.S. District Judge John Paul Engelmeyer's Saturday decision in New York denying Musk's Department of Government Efficiency access to the Treasury Department's confidential central payment system. Trump contends his proxies must be allowed to hunt for waste, fraud, and abuse within the executive branch. "We're very disappointed with judges that would make such a ruling," Trump said. "No judge should frankly be allowed to make that kind of decision. It's a disgrace." Disputes over the rulings and others could lead to a constitutional showdown between the Trump administration and the judiciary that redefines limits on executive power, according to some Democrats and legal experts. "The separation of powers is the foundation of democracy and individual liberty," Liz Gauthier, a legal expert at the Brennan Center for Justice in New York University, said in a post on X. "There's a word for political systems in which leaders decide which laws to follow and whether their own actions are legal. Dictatorships." Disputes over federal court decisions come at a time when Roberts, who serves as head of the federal judiciary, has warned that judges must remain independent of the other two branches of government. Within the past few years, however, elected officials from across the political spectrum have raised the specter of open disregard for federal court rulings, Roberts wrote on his December 31st in his report on the judiciary, without citing examples. "These dangerous suggestions, however sporadic, must be soundly rejected." Vance said a judge couldn't tell a general how to conduct a military operation. "Judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power," Vance said in a post on X. Political rivals blasted Vance's position. Rep. Dan Goldman, Democrat from New York, said in a post on X, The judiciary makes sure the executive follows the law. And if you do, then you won't have problems. Former Transportation Senator Secretary Pete Buttigieg on a post on X that decisions about what is legal and illegal are made by courts of law, not by the vice president. Former Rep. Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming, said that the administration feels any rulings are setting an unconstitutional limits on the executive. The recourse is appeal. You don't get to rage quit the republic just because you're losing, Cheney said in a post on X. That's tyranny. Gauthier at the Brennan Center said that Trump's administration appears to be gearing up to defy court orders. Courts, she said, will decide what the legitimate power of the executive branch. The answer to that question is 100% settled, and it's been for 222 years, when the Supreme Court famously recognized that it is emphatically the province and duty of the Judicial Department to say what the law is, Gauthier posted on X. Apparently all that waste and fraud the Doge bags are rooting out was instrumental in Trump's road to extreme wealth. Donald Trump, his shadow president Elon Musk, and the so-called Department of Government Efficiency are waging a highly illegal rampage through the federal budget. Among the first wave of intended victims are thousands of scientists across the country who depend on federal grants and loans to fuel their research. The administration is trying to unilaterally slash billions of dollars from the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. To defend this, Musk claims it's a ripoff when grant funding goes to pay for salaries, lab space, and equipment, even though no one can conduct scientific research without these baseline necessities. Trump and King Musk frame this as a shot at the baddies like Harvard and Yale, but this absolutely destroys public schools, and every state has those, and they are all doing scientific research, historian Eric Loomis explained at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Even Republican senators are having trouble concealing their panic as public universities are economic centers in many red states. Musk's ingratitude is breathtaking. It also fits the larger pattern of tech billionaires spitting venom at the middle-class workers who did the real labor in creating the products those capitalists profit so handsomely from. Noting that neither Trump nor Musk has the legal authority to make these cuts, Rep. Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, the ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee, said they are causing irreparable damage to ongoing research to develop cures and treatments for cancer, Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, ALS, diabetes, mental health disorders, opioid abuse, genetic diseases, rare diseases, and other diseases and conditions affecting American families. And she's just talking about the NIH money. The larger assault on universities and the NSF will likely undermine researchers in every field from biology to astrophysics. It's no surprise that Trump hates science. He is, after all, the same man who confidently declared he had a cure for COVID-19 that those silly medical researchers had overlooked, injecting household cleaners directly into your lungs. He's no doubt still nursing the narcissistic injury when people laughed at him for being so fuddingly stupid. But despite his own painful, obvious blind spots, Musk should know better than this. After all, if it weren't for government-funded research, Musk would be an anonymous failed son living off his daddy's money instead of a billionaire competing with Kanye West for the title of the world's most cringeworthy celebrity. Despite the media hype painting Musk as a genius and inventor, he largely built his financial empire on other people's research. At every turn, he's relied heavily on technologies developed because of the very federal largesse he now deems a ripoff. He'll never admit it, but Musk owes former Vice President Al Gore a giant thank you. Gore did not claim, as conservatives pretend he did, to invent the internet, but Gore was telling the truth when he said, during my service in the United States Congress, I took the initiative in creating the internet. He spent the better part of two decades promoting the internet, backing legislation to fund its development, and organizing research agencies to make it happen. As early pioneers in the internet's development, Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn explained in 2000, Al Gore was the first political leader to recognize the importance of the internet and to promote and support its development. And no other elected official, to our knowledge, has made a greater contribution over a longer period of time. Musk got rich because of all this work. In the 90s, he built a website called Zip2 that functioned as an online Yellow Pages. He sold it to Compaq in 1999, netting $22 million. He made another huge chunk of money as the CEO of PayPal, which would also not exist but for decades of government-funded development of the internet. Musk deserves credit for developing coding skills at a time when the internet was still new, of course. But he also just got really lucky at being a young man when decades of taxpayer-funded research into the internet was finally paying off. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Bribing foreign officials to get the overseas business is fair game, according to the felon-in-chief. President Donald Trump signed an executive order this week pausing enforcement of federal law that makes it a crime for U.S. businesses to bribe foreign officials, saying the law puts companies at a disadvantage on the global stage. Trump ordered newly confirmed Attorney General Pam Bondi to immediately stop actions taken under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or FCPA, including prosecutions of American individuals and companies who the Justice Department has charged with bribing foreign government officials in attempts to gain business in other countries. It sounds good on paper, but in practicality, it's a disaster, Trump said. It means that if an American goes over to a foreign country and starts doing business over there, legally, legitimately, or otherwise, it's almost a guaranteed investigation, indictment, and nobody wants to do business with the Americans because of it. He added, "It was a Jimmy Carter concept, and it sounds so good, but it's so bad. It hurts the country, and many, many deals are unable to be made because nobody wants to do business." The new order is aimed at restoring American economic competitiveness by having Bondi draw up revised reasonable enforcement guidelines for the Federal Corruption Practice Act of 1977, according to a White House fact sheet obtained by USA Today. American national security depends on America and its companies gaining strategic commercial advantages around the world, and President Trump is stopping excessive, unpredictable FCPA enforcement that makes American companies less competitive, the fact sheet said. The White House fact sheet also said U.S. companies are harmed by FCPA overenforcement because they are prohibited from engaging in practices common among international competitors, creating an uneven playing field. All current and past actions also will be reviewed, and the White House said. And once Bondi issues new relaxed guidelines, all future FCPA investigations and enforcement actions will be governed by this new guidance and must be approved by the Attorney General, the White House said. The White House said over time, FCPA interpretation and enforcement by U.S. prosecutors has broadened, imposing a growing cost on our nation's economy. In 2024, it said that the Justice Department and Securities Exchange Commission filed 26 FCPA-related enforcement actions, and at least 31 companies were under investigation by year's end. Over the past decade, the White House said that there's been an average of 36 FCPA-related enforcement actions per year, draining resources from both American businesses and law enforcement. Gary Kalman, executive director of Transparency International US, said Trump's order diminishes and could pave the way for completely eliminating the crown jewel in the US's fight against global corruption. Since it was passed in 1977, Kalman said the FCPA has not only allowed the Justice Department to prosecute individuals and companies that pay bribes to foreign officials, but also forced firms to establish strict accounting requirements and controls in order to prevent them from covering up such crimes. As such, he said, it's become a model law that has been emulated across the world. The FCPA helps make American companies and the Made in America brand stronger, more attractive, Kalman said, by proving that American goods and services are sought after because of their merit, not simply because they outbribe their competitors. Trump weighed trying to scrap the law entirely during his first term after hearing complaints from U.S. companies, Bloomberg reported in 2020. Then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson opposed the proposal. The new directive would have significant ripple effects within international legal services, and at the Justice Department and the FBI, which often spend years investigating and prosecuting such cases or negotiating plea agreements and deferred prosecution agreements. Many of those corrupt and wasteful federal employees live right here in Florida, and they will be missed when they go. President Donald Trump is making good on his campaign pledge to dismantle the deep state with a return-to-office mandate and resignation program designed to reduce the ranks of federal workforce. He's directed much of his ire at federal offices in Washington, D.C., and has promised to move some out of the nation's capital. But 4/5 of federal workers already live outside of the D.C. area, or about 94,000 of them call Florida home. At least 32,000 live in Tampa Bay, according to membership totals from the American Federation of Government Workers, a major union. They work for key resources during storm season, like the National Hurricane Center in Miami and the Federal Emergency Management Agency. They staff veterans affairs hospitals and guide Transportation Security Administration lines at Tampa International Airport. They process Social Security checks and tax documents at the Internal Revenue Service. By last week, around 65,000 workers out of some 2.4 million had taken the Trump administration buyout, which offers pay through September, according to Reuters. Those departures represent less than 3% of the federal workforce. It's unclear how many of those leaving live in Florida. A federal judge extended a temporary pause on the program into this week as he considers whether to halt it indefinitely amid legal challenges from labor unions. Three workers based in Tampa Bay and Central Florida spoke with the Tampa Bay Times under the condition of anonymity, due to concerns their jobs would be jeopardized. They said they won't leave willingly, but they're anticipating scenarios where they're laid off or fired after the buyout deadline passes. The Trump administration plans for, quote, sweeping layoffs to follow the buyout offer, according to CNN. One research scientist at the United States Geological Survey in Tampa Bay is staging parking lot conversations with colleagues where they weigh how they'll preserve public access to data on coastal erosion and water levels if they're forced out. That data helps counties and cities weigh flood risks, she said. We have moorings and instrumentation deployed in the oceans right now, collecting data and collecting samples, she said. What happens if we're not there? Others have turned to encrypted platforms like Signal to talk amongst themselves. Hundreds of miles from the White House, workers fear one wrong word through an official channels could get them fired. I've lost a bunch of weight. I'm not eating. I'm not sleeping. U.S. Geological Survey scientists said when it comes to future layoffs, we don't know who and we don't know why and we don't know when. Signs of abnormality are everywhere when Florida's federal workers got the resignation offer, according to two National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration employees interviewed by the Times. There were subtle threats, the email said. There was no guarantee employees would lose their jobs after the buyout deadline. Messages came after hours from government-wide human resources email address. The messages looked like spam, the worker said. Pretty much nothing is coming through our normal channel of command, said one National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration employee based in Central Florida. All they're doing is fomenting more anxiety, and part of me feels like that's the point. The American Federation of Government Employees filed a lawsuit earlier this month alleging the buyout offer is illegal because it promises employees salaries beyond March 14th when government funding expires. There's no guarantee beyond that date that employees will get their payouts, according to the union. Being an inspector general is a good way to get fired these days. The inspector general for the U.S. Agency for International Development was fired on Tuesday, a USAID official said, a day after his office published a report critical of the Trump administration's effort to eliminate the agency. Paul Martin, who had served as the agency's inspector general, a position requiring U.S. Senate confirmation since December 2023, the USAID official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive matters said Martin was removed from his position. Martin was informed by email from Trent Morse, deputy director of the Office of Presidential Personnel. Morse told Martin that his position at USAID Inspector General was terminated, effective immediately, a copy of the email showed. No reason was provided. The White House did not have any comment. The Inspector General's office on Monday released a report that said the Trump administration's move to dismantle USAID has crippled its ability to conduct oversight of unspent aid worth $8.2 billion. The report said staff cuts and stop work orders have made it difficult to ensure taxpayer-funded aid would end up in the hands of those intended. Poet Amanda Gorman warns parents to beware of book bans. When Amanda Gorman read her poem, The Hill We Climb, at former President Joe Biden's inauguration, she became the youngest poet to deliver a poem at a presidential inauguration. Although the 26-year-old Los Angeles native says she felt immense sense of pride at being included in such an important moment in American history, she had no idea her work would resonate the way it did. And in a recent interview with Meet the Press, Gorman opened up to moderator Christian Welker about how she felt when she learned that there was an active campaign to remove The Hill We Climb from schools around the country. Gorman told Welker she wrote the inaugural poem on the eve of January 6th after watching the violent attack at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. unfold on television. It felt like something I needed to read in the moment, she said. It was important for me to just process my own emotions and thoughts as an American, watching that violence against our democracy. Gorman's main message in the poem is one of unity and resilience in the face of division. She writes, "So we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know how to put our future first. We must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all." But in 2023, a parent in Miami area school complained The Hill We Climb contained indirect hate speech and that it would cause confusion and indoctrinate children. As a result, access to the poem is restricted to middle school students in the district. Gorman told Welker that learning the poem she wrote to inspire hope in the country was banned felt like a gut punch. "I understood that book bans had been happening, but I think this hit me so incredibly hard because not just that it was something that I had written, which was besides the point, but that it was a moment in history," she said. If a child wanted to hear words that were spoken at a presidential inauguration for their country, it had been kind of softly restricted in that way. In the interview, Gorman cautioned parents to be awake to what is happening on a local level in terms of book bans, particularly because they will disproportionately impact children from middle and lower class families who aren't otherwise able to afford to buy every book they need or want to read. These books that are being banned predominantly feature authors of characters and characters of color, authors and characters of the LGBTQ community, and so we're seeing entire identities erased from the bookshelves, she said. And when a child can't see themselves represented in a story, they can't dream of their own life to actualize their hopes. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my conversation with Gerardo Reyes Chavez from the Fair Foods Program.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome Gerardo Reyes Chavez, a farm worker and staff member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a national rights leader, and a spokesman for the Fair Food Program, sprung from efforts by the Immokalee workers to improve pay for farm workers picking tomatoes in Florida, to an international force for improving conditions for farm workers around the world. How you doing today, Geraldo?
Very good, Lou. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, and how you came to work with CIW and the Fair Foods Program. You know, I understand that you literally have firsthand knowledge of the plight of farm workers.
Yes. I am from Zacatecas, Mexico, and I have been working with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers for the past 25 years. I got involved because when we started working here, harvesting tomatoes, in 1999, there was a boss who refused to fire us when we asked for $20 of payment of the work we had already done for about 2 weeks. And then got mad when we refused to continue to buy the food that one of his relatives was selling for us and getting us sick in the fields. When we asked for those 20 bucks, it was to buy utensils and basic staples, and he got offended by it. So he fired us. We were in the same week, effectively, without a home, without money, and without a job. And we didn't know anyone. That was our welcoming to Immokalee and to the agricultural industry in Florida. And in that desperate search for a job, I met with someone who in our world is called a chivero. That's a crew leader, but for the harvesting of oranges, that gave us a job, and she connected us later with some workers that were coming back from Chicago. Those workers were part of the second case of modern-day slavery that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers helped to bring to justice by connecting the workers with the authorities that did the investigation, resulting in the second case, the Cuello case, being resolved and apprehension orders being executed. So these workers were my friends. They became roommates, and they introduced me to the CIW, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. So I got involved in the weekly meetings, and that's how my story began with this work. I'm a farm worker. You are very correct. Many of us, the staff of CIW, come from that reality, from the realities of the fields. And we have been working, combining our participation with what's going on in the community through the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. So I was working for 14 seasons. 14 seasons harvesting watermelons with a crew that we form. It's a harvesting cooperative. And I was combining working in the fields with also organizing. For me, been a really transformational path where I have been learning a lot of regarding to the way in which we as a community have been pushing for change since 1983 when the coalition began before my time. There were a lot of efforts, a lot of actions that took place, general strikes, a hunger strike, a march against violence, thousands of people organizing in the community to demand a place on the table to talk about how to change two fundamental things. One, to change the stagnation of wages that since 1978 was 40 to 45 cents, and it would continue like that for more than 30 years. And also to address the imbalance of power between workers and their employers. That imbalance is reflected on all the abuses that are very common in the culture, like situations of violence, situations of wage theft, situations of sexual harassment affecting most women in the fields, many other problems, but in the extreme, situations of modern-day slavery, where workers have been forced to work on the threat of death for them, and sometimes even for their families, the imposition of illegal recruitment fees, then get enforced with violence and threats. Those cases have happened very constantly in the agricultural industry. And so that was what the community wanted to eliminate. Those conditions needed to improve. Or some of those abuses obviously need to be eliminated. And many of those conditions were part of the day-to-day life of every worker. So that's how I got involved. We did a march of 234 miles from Fort Myers to Orlando. That was the first action that I was participated in 2000. And since then, the community changed course because we understood that we were not going to be able to achieve the systemic change that we were looking for as a community unless we change the focus of the campaign to include also the big buyers of the tomatoes we produce in this case. To agree to buy responsibly, to sign on to an agreement with the workers of Moncalí. Because at the end, if you think about who has more power in the supply chain, you're going to realize really quickly that the agricultural industry is a subset of sorts for the retail food industry in this country. Big brands of fast food, supermarkets, food providers, they have more power as buyers than the industry that supplies them. So they set the terms. And when it comes to prices, we realize that when corporations place this invisible hand, invisible for most people, on top of the agricultural industry, asking for lower prices in the produce, then the agricultural industry cut costs of production. But they're not going to do it with John Deere, Monsanto, or other corporations that supply them because they are bigger. The only place where they can cut that cost of production that's required to maintain those contracts is by keeping wages low, by cutting costs with the workers. And that's what we have seen. That's why wages were stagnant. That's why there was no obvious way out when our universe was ending at the gate of the farms where we work. But when we change the question of the organizer, which seeks to resolve the issues, to make the abuses stop, and include the question of the economist, who benefits the most, was the question. The answer is fundamentally different, and then it allows you to establish the link. That link is what we brought in the national tours that we started to do in 2001, after trying to communicate with Taco Bell, realizing there was a connection through a report that came out on a magazine called The Packer. It's an industry magazine. They were talking about how beautiful it was to have this connection with companies producing tomatoes here in our area. So we thought, that by communicating with them, we had a natural ally that they would naturally not want to be associated with an industry that was refusing to be changed its ways. But we were wrong. So that required a national boycott. We crossed the country several times in the span of 4 years, connected with students, connected with different congregations at a local, but also at the national level. The National Council of Churches, representing 32 different denominations in this country, more than 50 million people of faith have heard of the workers of Immokalee and our plight. And we're opening the doors so that we could start on the national tours to give presentations, to connect with those communities. The students were doing their part also. Inside different universities, they were trying to cut contracts that Taco Bell had with the universities where they were attending through the Boot the Bell campaign. So that was part of the larger effort of the boycott of Taco Bell. And more than 300 universities were organizing in solidarity with the workers of Immokalee, as well as some high schools in the mix. And all of that culminated with the first agreement of its kind in 2005, where Taco Bell and its parent company, John Brands, which owned KFC, Long John Silver, Pasta Bravo, among others. And this agreement set the path that others would have to follow. The campaign continued, and we reached agreements with McDonald's, with Burger King, with Subway, with Compass Group, Bon Appetit, Aramark, Sodexo, even Walmart. So we have 14 agreements up to now. And it was the power of the market saying we're going to buy, implementing the demands of the campaign, which were the zero tolerance policies for modern day slavery that has expanded to include child labor, and also to include the elimination, the zero tolerance for sexual assault. That means that none of those, like, for example, if there's a case of modern-day slavery in any of the participating farms under the Fair Food Program, they're not going to be able to sell their tomatoes to any of the corporations that have signed on to it, as well as with systemic child labor, for example. So what we did with the program effectively was to create consequences for abusive behavior and in some cases criminal behavior within this industry, because where in the past there was nothing, there was no consequence. Even rights that are written in the law were being stepped on or ignored. So the program brings responsibility in the supply chain, and it has worked in a wonderful way.
Yeah, it is actually, yes, and it is referred to as worker-driven social responsibility. You know, I'd just like to clarify for my listeners, you know, just how hard you had to work to earn a living before these contracts were in place. Like, what was the rate for picking tomatoes, and how many did you have to pick to make a quarter, you know, or 25 cents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the rate was 40 to 45 cents, and that was since 1978, more than three decades.
How many did you have to pick to get that 45 cents? Did you have to pick like a bushel of them or something?
Well, because it is by piece, by the bucket, all right? So you have to, and if the payment of minimum wage, for example, increases, that wasn't necessarily good news for workers back then. Outside the program, it continues to not be a good thing for the workers, because when you are paid by the bucket, then in the past, for example, at 40 to 45 cents, you would have to pick around 2.5 tons of tomatoes just to make the equivalent minimum wage of that time. So when there's an increase, then you are pushed to harvest more. because workers don't get, or at least outside of the program and everywhere before the program existed, you wouldn't get compensated to catch up with minimum wage laws in this country.
And that low pay, I guess, you know, kind of puts you behind the eight ball, and that's part of how these situations of, I guess, quote unquote, modern day slavery could occur to a basic stop.
Yes, and that's you are totally on point with that, because modern day slavery doesn't happen in a vacuum. So it's because of all the conditions that are so backwards that modern day slavery can have the oxygen to not just exist but even flourish. And in fact, a prosecutor called the state while all of these cases were happening almost every year. There was an ongoing investigation or a case. And he said that Florida was ground zero for modern day slavery to happen. And the analysis we have is that modern day slavery is a continuum from the compilation of bad conditions that are part of the way in which food is being produced in this country. So we knew that to eradicate that, we needed to improve the conditions as a whole in a systemic way. And guess what, Lou? It has worked. And it is, it's been working since 2011 when we started to implement the program. Since 2010 with some growers, with a smaller group, 2011 with the Florida Tomato Growers Exchange that represents 80% of the tomato producers based in Florida, but with land up and down the East Coast. And when we reached the agreement with Walmart, which I mentioned before, that allowed us to expand those protections to all the states in which these companies, these growers, are producing tomatoes up the East Coast to 10 states. This past year...
I want to continue with that, but I need to interrupt for a second and remind people who are just tuning in. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Geraldo Reyes Chavez from the Fair Food Project and the Council of Immokalee Workers. Yeah, you were saying that, yes, this expanded in the United States to many states. Are you telling us about that?
Exactly. So the Fair Food Program, as I was mentioning, was in operation in 10 different states. Since we started, it has been expanded. And this past year, the United States Department of Agriculture gave it a recognition. This recognition is naming it with their highest ranking, which is platinum level, the highest they have. Now, what does that mean? That means that they recognize the program as the best system to eliminate, and not just eliminate, but prevent abuses from happening in the agricultural industry of the United States. Along with that, they, in their own program, they incorporated the call for attention to this system. And they decided that they were going to incentivize growers who decided to join the Fair Food Program. And what we saw since June last year, a surge in interest increasing by growers that started to connect with the Fair Food Standards Council. I wanted to just clarify that, mentioning that the FFSC, Fair Food Standards Council, is the organization that was created with the task of overseeing compliance and ensure that the Fair Food Program it's being applied as it should, based on the agreements both with growers and the legally binding agreements with the corporations, and also to receive the complaints of workers, which is the most important and the key aspect of everything we do here, which is guaranteeing that through these agreements, workers are free to talk without fear of retaliation. And when they complain, that's an opportunity for every farm where those complaints are coming from to improve, so that they can be the better companies that they can be with the help of workers. So it's a benefit to everyone. It's a benefit for workers because they don't have to give up their dignity while they are producing the food. It includes a bonus that gets paid by corporations participating. Since the program started to be implemented in 2011, there's been more than $45 million that have been distributed to workers in all of these farms across several states, as I was mentioning, and in the form of a bonus, clearly stated in their pay stub. Also, the right to complain without fear of retaliation has captured more than 4,000 complaints. All of them have been investigated and resolved, and they have resulted in the transformation that we have been able to witness in the way in which food is being produced, with growers that see the workers and the coalition as partners in the application of these new rights. All of this is what's been expanded when farmers contacted us after the USDA announced that the incentives they were going to be given to farms that qualify, that do everything so that they can be in the program. And 30 new operations, 30 new farms in 13 new states, so 23 states in total, are seeing the program being implemented in different forms and different scales also because of the sizes of farms can vary across the country and different crops too.
Yeah, and I understand that the Fair Foods program is expanding overseas. It's becoming international. What other countries have you established this program?
Yes, well, the Fair Food program it's expanding, but also the WSR model, or Worker-Driven Social Responsibility model, which the Fair Food program is basically the first WSR. But we call it that when it is being expanded, but also adapted onto other industries, not just agriculture. In agriculture, though, it has been expanded internationally, too. With the agreements that we have with a farm that produces tulips, for example, in Virginia. The name of the company is Blumia, and they are producing in Chile and also in South Africa. So the expansion of the Fair Food program itself has been happening internationally too, in a little bit less bigger of a scale than the WSR model, and here is why. When we started to implement the program, other workers in other industries, first here in the U.S., started to pay attention to this. So workers from Vermont, for example, through Migrant Justice, started to reach out. They wanted to learn how we were able to create the Fair Food program and wanted to learn how this works. So they started to shadow our process of education, worker to worker, inside these farms, to see how we did it. They started to learn about the educational materials that we use, shadow us in the campaigning, with the campaign for Fair Food, because as you know, we have, also a campaign where we are asking right now Kroger supermarket to join the program. And there's a national boycott of Wendy's. Where we are asking them to also join the program. Both brands have been linked to cases of modern-day slavery, and there's no need for any of that to be happening when you have a program that effectively eliminates the most common abuses and in the process that help us prevent cases of modern-day slavery, and it works. It works. So we have a solution. We want to share it, but these corporations and other corporations too, like Publix here in Florida, they need to recognize that this is an opportunity to do business in a way in which business do not crush the workers in the supply chain by simply demanding the implementation of the program with us by signing onto the program, and by using the power, cut purchases if necessary, when violations of zero tolerance happen, and then switch to buy from another firm that is in compliance. So we're asking them to bring their suppliers if they feel more comfortable like that, or join, or both, join the growers that are already part of it. So this process helps the workers on the dairy industry in Vermont, as I was mentioning before, to understand the ins and outs of the program, the ins and outs of the campaign for fair food. And they were able, with our support, to establish something they call the Milk with Dignity program. In an agreement with Ben & Jerry's, they are doing something similar, but they adapted the Fair Food program to address the abuses that you see on the dairy industry. It has been working with the participation of Ben & Jerry's, and they are currently asking the supermarkets of Hannaford to also join. Similar things are going on in construction in Minneapolis, Twin Cities. Workers represented by CETUL, Centro de Trabajadores Unidos en la Lucha, they created something they call BDR, or Building with Dignity and Respect, and reached agreements with nonprofit construction companies to implement, again, the adapted version of the Fair Food Program, basically, onto the context and address the abuses, the risks, and everything that have to do and needs to improve in that sector. And just recently, there's going to be a collaboration between those two organizations in the expansion, again, with a non-for-profit construction company that wants to do the right thing as a business, not as a business, but as a company, incorporating the protections that were crafted as an iteration of all of these. That's what we call the WSR. So that's in U.S. soil. Across the globe, this has sparked the imagination of many, many workers in many different industries and businesses as well, because this is a good thing to have. If you were a business and you want to do something that addresses abuses in your supply chain, this is the way to go. And this is the most effective way to do it. When workers are at the center, when they are the auditors of their own rights in the place of work, they are able to see everything that's wrong. They know where it hurts. They know what needs to be done. And the program is there to make sure that when that's identified, then we can work together as partners and address it. So outside of the U.S., the WSR model that I'm referring to, it's been explored. There's been a lot of conversations going on, and we hope to land it soon in Chile with workers that are diverse within the salmon industry, the second most important industry for the Chilean economy. So that's what's going on.
I'll tell you what, you know, that sounds great, but unfortunately I'm coming to the end of my segment, and I really want to thank you, Geraldo Reyes Chavez, for making time for us today and telling us this really compelling story about how perhaps things are changing for, you know, some of the more vulnerable workers in our society. Thank you again, Geraldo. If you want, tell my listeners how they can learn more about CIW and the Fair Foods program.
Yes, thank you, Lou. Thank you for having us. You can learn more at our website, www.ciw-online.org, and there you can read more about our campaigns. And thank you again.
Beautiful. Thank you.
President Donald Trump faces a vote by the Philadelphia Eagles team over a White House visit following their Super Bowl 59 win against the Kansas City Chiefs. The Eagles emphatically won a second Super Bowl, scoring 34 unanswered points on their way to a 40-22 win in New Orleans. This left the Chiefs' hope for a historic NFL three-peat in tatters. It's been a tradition for the winner of America's national sports leagues, the NFL, the NBA, MLB, and NHL, to visit the White House and celebrate their victory with the sitting president. However, the last time the Eagles scooped up the Vince Lombardi Trophy in 2018, their White House visit was canceled due to a disagreement with Trump about not standing during the national anthem. The Eagles were set to visit Trump that year. However, it was reported that Philadelphia